Hello, everyone. Today we have a really special guest, Timothy.
Hello, guys.
Before I start to introduce him to you guys, I would like him to introduce himself.
Great. So this camera, I'll choose this one.
Yeah, okay.
So hi, guys. My name's Tim. I'm a DOP, producer, director. Probably you guys are sensing a trend. I think we wear many hats as filmmakers, so I'm one of those. But I also do have a production house in Dubai. With a couple of business partners and a great team. So we've been doing that for about 11 years now. We moved here in 2013. We're in Kuwait now. I forget we're not in Dubai. So but it's lovely to be here in Kuwait and with AAB World and in their beautiful showroom. And it's lovely to be with you today and have this podcast.
So, same. Yeah. Thank you. So, Tim, how did you start to become a director of photography? Did it happen from the first time you started as a filmmaker and then from that way you discover that I want to be a DP?
So for me, I think it was accidental. I didn't study filmmaking.
Okay.
So I actually, when I was very young, I had a hobby, you know, kite surfing.
Yeah.
We do it on land in the UK. We just call it kiteboarding. It's a similar thing. And I just, you know, filmed myself doing that as a hobby with my friends, and we made videos on Movie Maker. Do you remember Movie Maker?
Yeah, I do remember.
If anyone remember that? Yeah,
the free software that's on Windows.
Yeah, exactly. I remember it used to crash after a few minutes of me trying to make a video because the hardware was terrible. I didn't know why. So I'd have to save it, do a mover clip, and it would crash, and then I'd reopen it.
God.
So yeah, the pains. So I did that when I was like really young, like 12, 13, 14, 15, etc. And obviously the hobby kind of fizzled as I went to college and I got into motorsport engineering, and I was really fascinated with cars as well as kites, but obviously kiting went on the back burner, and I was finding myself working in an industry that I didn't really enjoy. So after studying motorsport engineering, I worked at race teams, I worked building supercars, I worked with engineering places, parts distribution places, I did everything, but I kept job hopping. I wasn't happy, and I ended up moving away temporarily, and only to find myself having an offer from the circuit, the race circuit, where I studied motorsport engineering to do a media role.
Okay.
Which I did graciously accept and went and did that. But obviously I wasn't a filmmaker and I was actually supposed to be managing content for the circuit. And they only knew me because I studied there. But they were aware that I used to make videos when I was younger, just for myself. So they did say that, you know, they were aware of my experience in that respect. And luckily they entrusted me to, I actually suggested the idea, may I hire some equipment as opposed to you hiring crews, so I can just learn effectively as events happen and I can document it for us. And after 2-3 years of just constant camera time, I got okay. I got pretty decent. I didn't really, I didn't study it. I didn't really read too much into the theory behind things. I just literally had as much camera time. I had thousands of hours of camera time. And again, thanks to the networking and the kiting community, I had my business partner, Peter Farrow. He's an ex-BBC engineer in the UK, near where I used to live. And he actually saw an opportunity to invest in us both and start a business. And so the rest is history. And we basically, after almost the first year of working together and him buying a Sony EX1, which was our first Sony camera, because I'm a Sony ambassador, forgot to say that in the introduction, guys. We worked with that camera for almost 2-3 years. We traveled to 22 countries in our first couple of years. We ended up working with the Time Attack race series. We did content for Santa Pod Dragship Raceway. We worked with Ferrari Challenge. We ended up meeting a lot of really high net worth individuals in the motorsport community, which at the time was accidental, but looking back on it was very smart, because one of the things we have to recognize as filmmakers is that we need to understand who we're working with should, first of all, be enjoyable, but two, also pay well.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a good target market to be in, or a good industry to be niched in, because we were working with people that had money, because you have to have money to be in motorsport. And two, we really enjoyed it. So obviously we put a lot of hours in without any problem because we really lived and breathed it. And I met my second business partner, Rajiv Varani. He's an ex-Bollywood director from Mumbai. And we were serving an Indian billionaire client who was flying us around the world with Peter and Rajiv, and only a few years in of that relationship, we bonded so well that we decided to start a company in Dubai together.
Wow.
So I pretty much reset, moved to Dubai, and then my first 2-3 years were pretty terrible. because moving to any country where you're, I mean, I knew how to make films and I knew how to do content. I'd already done hundreds of like ads, commercials, event coverage films. So I knew what I was doing, but I didn't know the market. I didn't know how to market myself. I wasn't a businessman. And I think that's like a lot of DPs. Their problem is that there's a lot of very talented people out there, but they just don't have the clients or the opportunities. So for me, when I moved to Dubai, that was a big shock. Even for Rajiv and Peter, who were seasoned businessmen. But I mean, again, they were known in their respective countries and industries. They also felt the same pains. So it took us 3-4 years to get ahead. And then fast forward to now, we're a team of 20 and we've worked with people like Will Smith. We do work frequently with Red Bull. We've worked with the Emirates Group. We do all the content for Jumeirah. We get to work with some of the biggest names you can imagine. We produced Indian Matchmaking, which is a hit show that's won an Emmy on Netflix. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, we're doing constant stuff like this. I literally flew in 2 days ago from Dubai doing a shoot for Gulf Oils and Lincoln. And I had a team doing COP28. And we had a team working for Michelin Guide. And we had a team also working for Mitsubishi around GCC. That was all last week. So now we're turning over, like, I'd say at least 6 productions a week. And we're doing really well, and the team's amazing, and it's been a hell of a journey.
Wow, that's really amazing. So I have a lot of questions.
Go for it, sorry.
No, it's okay. So you mentioned that you didn't study, and that's a question that me, myself, I've been asked a lot, that is it necessarily to go to film school in order to be a DP or a director or work in that industry?
I think it's important to recognize that let's not exclude education here. I think take university or the name away from it. Education is very important. Now, there's different types of education. So for me, I had mentoring.
Okay.
Even though it was maybe not structured, but without Peter and Rajiv, one being ex-BBC to be technical, one being Bollywood to help creativity, I got a lot of education from that experience. I also learned by failure. That was also a form of education. And then a few years in, I obviously did study business and study filmmaking more as I got more proficient in my career. I just wish I adopted it sooner. If I was speaking to someone new, do you need filmmaking? Do you need to study filmmaking in like a university to make it as a DP? My answer would say no, because we're in an information age. I think the problem is right now, we've got so much information available to us. Like, you can go on YouTube right now and you'll have millions of videos telling you how to shoot. The problem we have is how do we filter that to know what's correct and what isn't? Because anyone can pick up a camera and give knowledge.
True.
But is that knowledge correct?
Yeah.
And one of the things I do, as well as being a production house co-owner, Sony ambassador, I'm also a coach to filmmakers. I have a mentoring and an online course where I help filmmakers grow as a businessman. So I also do that as well. Nice. And for me, it's taken me 10, 11 years to get to the point where I feel I can pass on some things that I've implemented. And I think that's what it is. I think learn off people that you know have implemented it, because there is so many people giving advice out there that I would say probably don't have the authority to do so, because you've got to try and test it. And that's the benefit to university, is you're going to a venue or an establishment where the education is verified to some level. But we are in an age now where I think universities, we have to recognize, are still a business. They have got a price tag. Tens of thousands of dollars a year, in fact. And is it necessary for you to go to one to become a successful DP? Yes and no. I mean, if you want to go into the feature market and you want to reside in LA, for example, maybe it's wise that you do go to film school.
Yeah.
But if you want to start a business and be a freelancer DP and learn as you go, and you don't require any qualifications for someone to hire you, that isn't maybe feature, maybe it's more commercial, corporate and all that stuff, maybe you don't need it and you can save that money and invest that elsewhere. I mean, it's a money in, money out. A university is an investment. What do you get out of it? So just start looking at it like a piece of equipment, like this Sony Burano here. You've got to look at it. It's like, I buy that, what do I get out of it? And it's the same with education. So the benefit to cheap education, like unconventional education online, it's not as verified. You might buy some courses that might not help, some might do. But the risk is much lower. So I don't know. It's a very hard question to answer, because I think everyone's different. And I know people that have done very well going to film school. I do. I also know people that haven't done very well.
Exactly. And that's what I want to mention, is that there's no right way for, if I want to be a director or producer, that's the pathway that I should walk in order to achieve that goal. I would say that film school is a place where you can make mistakes without anyone have an eye on you, and you get, let's say, colleagues who are similarity in your passion, and they will help you in achieving and exploring and experimenting. But at the same time, you will not get the full access for the whole knowledge, because what you practice on set is much beneficial than what you're learning from the books. And the books does not have all the knowledge that you're seeking for.
True.
So it's, as you said, 50-50, it just depends. If you are having the opportunity to go to film school, yeah, go for it. Since you don't want to study something different major and hating it and eventually want to be a director. But if you didn't get the chance to be in a film school, that doesn't mean that you can go and pick up a camera and start learning from there.
Very true. I mean, I think the best way, I think, to accelerate your growth as a filmmaker, if you do not have budget for university, I think would be, it doesn't even matter if you have a phone, just learn the aspect of lighting, learn the aspect of storytelling, and hang around filmmakers. So it's not complicated if you, like, it's really quite straightforward. Your environment dictates your performance, right? And the people you hang around are the people you become. So if you can befriend someone that's above you that you respect in the industry, ask to offer your time for a few months, even a year, and learn under them, you'll get so much value out of that, and it wouldn't cost you much other than your own time, which you would be spending anyway going to university, and you'd be paying for it.
Yeah.
So if I had to give myself advice, what I would have done sooner is, as soon as I landed in Dubai, I would have befriended as many people as I could in the industry, which took me a couple of years to figure out. I would have read a lot more. I would have invested in online courses more. But my camera time was high. That's the one thing I did do correctly.
Okay.
And I'd also study business, because there's a massive gap here from being a filmmaker and being in business. We've got two duties. If you're going independent, the skill, the hard skill, and the soft skill. And the soft skill is the clients, it's the accounting, it's the marketing, it's the business development, it's the how you portray yourself, it's how you create a very good customer experience. The customer, the product, if you're a filmmaker, the product is not the video and the edit, it's not. It's how you speak to the client before the job. It's how you plan for the job. It's how you do the pre-production.
Yeah.
It's the shoot, it's the edit, and it's how you deliver the edit. It's then how you follow up to ensure the value of that edit was done and, you know, it was accurately scoped, and it's getting feedback. And then it's upselling afterwards or offering extra value, and then maintaining that relationship. That's the product.
That's bring me to the note that I went to the First and Ten production website, and there was a quote that caught my eye. I was like,
cool.
I'm gonna write it down.
What's
to
that?
Tell it to Tim.
What quote's that?
I need to go to my notes.
No worries.
So it say, we don't just see things for how they are, but how they could be.
Yeah.
And that's what quite interesting, because you're, as a production house, you don't care only about doing the production and delivering the product and that's all, but you care about the client, and you just, if I'm not mistakenly understanding that, you also give them strategies on how they maintain their work.
Yeah, we do. I mean, I think it's very true, we do. But I think it also, that will vary depending on the project and the client that comes to us. Because like an agency that would hire us would be responsible for all of that. So we know we're a gun for hire in that respect. Some clients that require a bit more strategy, we do invest and challenge a bit more why the content's being done. Sometimes we've turned to clients and said, this is not the correct time for you to invest in a video, for example.
Okay.
So like recently we had a client contact to us that that makes speakers.
Mm.
And they wanted a promotional video, but their website was very basic. The photos on that website didn't look great. Their social was non-existent, and they didn't really have a proper sales strategy where this video asset would be used. So it wouldn't be morally correct for me to make them a video that would effectively get 30 views on their YouTube channel. So the value is not there. And this is another thing that is a bit of a dilemma with filmmaking, is that we have to understand that content is only a cog in a much larger clock of cogs.
Yeah.
We, like, my friend Raj Kotecha runs this agency called CCA, Creative Content Agency, and he talks about the four P's. There's planning the content, which is the strategy in the business. There's the producing, which is what we do. There's the publishing of that content, and then the promoting of that content. And then the reporting to then repeat the process. We do one of four.
Okay.
Most filmmakers.
Yeah.
So the only way for us to grow and really understand value with clients is to know how to do the plan, the producing, the publishing, and the promoting. But most of us don't do that. I don't do that. Even First and Ten Productions does not plan their strategy to a T for a campaign, for a year, for a brand. We don't publish, we don't promote. So therefore that strategy and that value is going to be hindered because you're only given part of the puzzle.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And most filmmakers will also have this problem. It's very hard to pitch and show the value of content because it's also a hard to understand service. Like there's this chart, I can't remember who made it, but it's called the easy to buy scale. When you buy a product like a cup of coffee,
okay,
you don't need to be explained what it is. It's a cup of coffee. It's going to give you a caffeine hit and you're going to feel more energy and it might taste nice and it's easy to buy. And the barista serving it could be not knowledgeable at all, could be even be rude to you and you still buy it. But with something very complicated, it requires a lot more rapport building, education and all that stuff. So we're in a very hard to understand service.
Okay.
You know, when you buy a product that's easy to understand, it doesn't require knowledge or rapport to be built. When you have a service that is complicated, it requires rapport and education for you to buy that service. And that's what we are. So we've just got to be very, very good at understanding our value and how that helps the client. So when it comes to strategy, going back to your original question, yes, we do offer strategies to our client, but sometimes it means also walking away. Because I don't believe you should ever take someone's money if you don't think it's going to achieve the results that they want to achieve. And 9 times out of 10, people that come to filmmakers, I feel, unless they're like agencies where they know what mm-hmm. they're doing, may not know what they want or know what would work.
Yeah.
So it's our job to educate them.
That's amazing. So you mentioned that you had a little bit of struggle when working in Dubai for the first 3-4 years.
Yeah.
So... And that's a question I'd ask you when I was meeting you in the Sony Venice 2, that you come from UK, and most people who are filmmakers from this region would love to work in UK or in America, you know, the high-end production.
Mm.
But UK citizen coming to Dubai
and
working and thriving there with a really big brands. So I asked you, why did you come here? So why did you pick up Dubai? And how did you overcome your challenges?
So I think Dubai was, it was a new, interesting market. It felt ahead of the curve at the time. And I think it was a good move to go to Dubai because it's still a very new country in that respect. A bit like Kuwait. I mean, it's still a very, the most of the GCC is quite new.
Quite close to you, though.
Yeah. And one thing I would say that Dubai is lacking, and it's not Dubai's fault, but it's just the talent pool is very small.
Okay.
So I'm very dedicated to what we produce in our company. I think our team works incredibly hard. And I think we produce some great content. Do I think it's the best content? No. Do I think our product's extraordinary? Yes. But like I said, the product isn't just the content, it's everything else around it. So I think we're particularly good at the bookends of this. I think we're very good at the client handling at the beginning and making them feel involved and looked after. And I think we look after them at the end as well. The product obviously could always go up or down sometimes, but that's where I feel we add the value. And if you're consistent enough and you're a man of your word and your character's strong, I think you'll do well in a country like Dubai, even now, because or any country in the GCC, because if you lack competition, you're a bigger fish in a smaller pond, so
yeah,
to speak.
I get you.
And if you go to like an LA, for example, right now and try to make it as a filmmaker, unless you do things very, very right, you'll find that your learning curve and your compound curve is going to be very long.
True.
Because you've got a lot of ground to make, reputation to make, you've got a lot of things to do right, and the room for error is very narrow, whereas the room for error in a country that doesn't have a large talent pool, you can afford to be a bit more, you can afford to make more mistakes.
Yes.
I don't know, consciously back then, moving to Dubai was like a tactical move, like I'm saying it. I think we were just presented with an opportunity and we decided to go for it. And was it the right move? Yes, I do think it was. I think, would I have made it in the UK? I'm not sure. But I know I wouldn't have had the opportunities like I would have done if I hadn't have gone to Dubai. So I owe Dubai pretty much an awful lot. Well, I owe Dubai everything to the fact that it's got such an attractive, obviously, place. It's very big on its tourism and it attracts a lot of, you know, productions and celebrities and events and that sort of thing. And that's kind of like what we've niched into. So your environment dictates your performance. And if you want to be known at something, you've got to look in the industry, what do you want to be known for? And you want to be in that environment. Like I've got a cameraman friend in Singapore that's a really good food DOP. And he's in one of the best cities in the world for food, wow. Singapore. So that's the place you need to be. You're not going to get that in another place. So you just got to figure out what your niche is. And that's a whole separate conversation, learning to niche.
But it's quite interesting because that's what I will always tell my colleagues, that we are in a country, not only in Kuwait, but also the GCC area, that you don't have that much competition, so you have the space and the freedom to explore, and the learning curve will be faster rather than just going to UK or America. Mm. So, shall we get into the cameras?
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about it.
Do you want to do FX6 first or Burano since it's here?
Well, I mean, let me just bring context to the cinema line just in case people don't know. So obviously, I mentioned earlier that I'm a Sony ambassador, and me and a few others in the region for Middle East and Africa, we're responsible for just bringing awareness and educational content centered around the cinema line.
Yeah.
What we have in front of us here is the newest camera in the fleet. It's not even out yet. It's called the Sony Burano. I'm particularly very excited to see what waves this thing makes in the industry, because I think it's quite revolutionary.
It is.
But I've put a lot of time and money as well into the cinema line, and I'm a big advocate for it. I know I'm an ambassador, so therefore I have my agenda with what I need to say, but everything I can assure you what I say about the cinema line is true. I wouldn't say it if it wasn't. So I've been a Sony ambassador since the beginning. It's just I've only become officially an ambassador in the last 4 or 5 years.
Why did you pick Sony?
At the time when I got Sony, I found the ergonomics of the camera were best suited. But as it's grown and I've realized what Sony have done, especially with now the Alpha range and the cinema line, I think they're one of the most innovative, like futuristic looking company out there. And you could argue they make a lot of products,
okay,
too many, but I would say what they're actually trying to do is give a product for almost every production or every person. People think that the smaller cinema line cameras offer for newer people or less experienced people. I would say that's the wrong way to look at it. It's a camera that would suit certain productions. So I use the FX30 and I use the Venice 2 all the time. And I use everything else in between. But the camera I use the most is the FX6.
Okay. So as I mentioned to you earlier, that whenever you have a video explaining anything or giving like tips and tricks, there's always these Sony cameras in the background. And I was like, wonder like which one he will grab today, because there's a lot of...
There is a lot, yeah. There's a lot.
So do you get that confusion like when you're working? I know like each project has a certain camera that suits it, but among all of them that you have, which one that you feel like can get my hand off?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on what the client wants. So like if I have a client wanting me to do event coverage, if they're wanting like a lot of... If I ask for a reference and they send lots of like gimbal work, I'm probably going to go with an FX3, because it's full frame. It's going to give me that nice depth of field, that field of view as well. It's also got the high base ISO, which means it's going to be absolutely phenomenal in low light.
Yeah.
And when I'm going into an event, I don't know what the environment's like, so I need to be prepared.
Okay.
And with an FX3, I can stick it on a gimbal easy. The FX6 also goes on a gimbal, but I would only put it on a gimbal over an FX3 is if we're doing maybe a lot of outside stuff where the ND would be really useful.
I have a question regarding FX6, FX30 and Burano.
Yeah.
They all have the full frame sensor, right?
Well, the FX30 is an APS-C Super 35. Okay. The only camera in the fleet in the cinema line at the minute that does not have a full frame sensor is the FX30.
Okay, so I'll exclude it from this question. So let's keep it between FX6 and the Burano. Sure. Since they have the Sony sensor full frame, do they have similarity in the term of image quality, latitude also? Like the dynamic range, how it handles the highlights and shadows, or each camera needs to be treated differently?
So the Burano has got a very different sensor, but there's technology that's shared. So the cinema line, just to bring context, you have the Venice.
Okay.
The original one that had the color science, the technology, and that's kind of drip fed into different products in the cinema line. So it's all stemmed from there. The Burano is very high up in the cinema line. It's just below Venice. So therefore it's gonna have the most tech and be the most advanced. So it's gonna be a lot better quality with the dynamic range, everything compared to the FX6. But the FX6 is really, really good. And on the grand scheme of things, I think you're splitting hairs. I mean, you could put an FX30 next to a Venice too and show most people in the public and they wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah, exactly.
But we filmmakers do. But obviously the difference is I said this yesterday in my workshop here at AAB. I don't think people should buy cameras on quality anymore. I think we're so focused as filmmakers on quality all the time. And I think in the end of the day, it's important, but it's not actually what we should use to buy cameras. We should buy it on the ergonomics, the community centered around the brand, like Alpha Universe. It should be centered around the ecosystem and the lenses that you can use across the range. It should be the price. Like, how soon can I make my money back with a Burano versus an FX6? So, like, honestly, like, I use the FX6 a lot, and I've made, God, I can't begin to fathom how much money I've made off that camera. And could I have used a Burano? Yes. But I've made my money back easier with an FX6 because I'm doing that sort of quick productions. But if I was doing features and very important commercials all the time, then I would be more geared towards the Burano. So I think the quality question only comes relevant when you know the kind of productions you're doing and the kind of tools that you need. Like, you do a lot of very high-end short films and commercials. You're up there when it comes to a scale of level of productions. I know the content you do. So the Burano for you and the Venice is more catered towards you than it probably is to me.
Yeah, because I can notice the latitude, how it deals yeah. differently with the lights and also the color science, like the color registered, because we did a test between the, if I'm not mistaken, I do not recall the models, was RE-LF, if I'm not mistaken, and the Sony Venice 2.
I think it was the Alexa 35. It's just the Venice workshop.
Not the Venice workshop. We did it with the DOP Sadiq Taqi.
Okay, yeah, I know him. Yeah, yeah.
So we did it at his place, and we had the camera next to each other, and mm-hmm. we had the same settings, same lighting. And I could notice two things, that Sony Venice registered the white right, mm-hmm. like accurate white, you see it. But when it comes to colors like green or blue, there is a little bit of shift. So these things, you just take it in your mind when it comes to like which camera to use regarding the color, latitude, and all this stuff.
Sure.
For high production, it does make a change.
Sure.
But if you're in the end working for like a social platform content, nobody gonna notice the difference. And we have the creator, the movie they use the Sony
Good
FX.
Point.
And it's really amazing picture.
Yeah.
You could not tell this was a small
Very
Sony
true.
Camera.
Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing point you just raised. I mean, the creator film, if you guys haven't watched it, do check it out. It's been used with the FX3. The Sony FX3 is obviously the second to smallest camera in the CineLine fleet. And they've done the entire feature film on that camera.
Exactly.
Now, to me, I think that's awesome. And I think a lot of it's also kind of set the tone that you don't need to always use something that's $200,000-$400,000
exactly.
with all the bits to run. So going back to your point where you talked about the colors not being exactly right. In the end of the day, I think if I showed four or five films to very experienced DPs and I said, tell me what camera was used, would they know?
No.
So then is the question then, do you really make your decision on what camera you buy based on quality? This goes back to what I was saying.
No.
I don't think you do. This is my opinion. I don't want to put any detriment down to Sony, but I want to kind of illustrate that there's a lot of brands out there, a lot of cameras where all the quality of them are quite good. I genuinely, if I gave you like a really old Canon bridge camera, like a 550D that's like 10 years old right now, and I gave you a Nifty 50 and I gave you some lights, you would get a lovely interview block, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because you know how to use the kit.
Exactly.
Now, I don't want to say that, I mean, I think Sony is superb in terms of its quality. I think it is superior, but take quality out of the equation for the minute. I think Sony is the best due to everything else that's in the ecosystem. And that's the reason why I think it's the value that it is. So I think, I just stress, it doesn't matter what camera you use, don't get caught up on quality. I think it's down to everything else around it.
It's not depending on the tools, because in the end, they are tools. You use them to eventually get a good look. You don't need the high resolution, you don't need these big cameras, because as we can see very clearly, you can use really small equipment to achieve a really good cinematic look.
You
as a viewer and audience, you will not tell the difference.
No. Very true. I mean, we're in an age now where technology has caught up. We buy cameras and other things now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Sony Burano, like, when I heard about this camera, I was really, really excited and interested. And when I went on YouTube, I couldn't see much people talking about it. And I wanted to see, like, more of test footage to learn more about the camera. And I know that you have spent some good time with it, and I would like to know more about it.
Yeah, I mean, so just to give it a quick summary.
Okay.
It's called the Sony Burano, and Burano is obviously a small, I think, island or village or a section in Venice.
Okay.
So that's, I don't know who I owe credit to that, but okay. I think it's very clever because it's like a little baby Venice.
Okay.
All right. So, but it's got a lot of attributes that the FX6 has. So for me, it's a really like perfect camera. So what's different from the FX6 versus the Venice with this is that it has an 8.6K sensor.
Okay.
It has obviously many scan modes that have, I think it's 5.8K Super 35 as well in it.
Oh, nice.
It's got inbuilt image stabilization. So as IBIS, the FX6 doesn't, nor does the Venice. So that has IBIS.
Okay.
It has a variable ND, which is a phenomenal feature to have in a job where you're not constantly changing filters. Every time I use an FX3 or a 30 and I'm having to use filters, it is really annoying.
It is.
So having a variable ND is really cool. And it's obviously, it's so user-friendly. It just pops on your shoulder or you can just hold it by your hip and it's very easy to use. You don't require a large team. In fact, I was shooting with Gulf Oils last week with it and it was just two of us pretty much manning the whole shoot, you know, from nice. from a camera perspective. And it's got E-mount and PL. So obviously a PL mount comes with it, but it's got E-mount, so it has autofocus, which is, again, phenomenal. The Venice 2 doesn't have autofocus.
Okay.
So the fact that I can put G-Masters on it and put it at 1.2, I've got a 50mm 1.2 on here right now, and I can point this at someone and move around and it's sharp, so I don't need to worry about focusing. I just focus on my composition.
Yeah.
So when you look at all these features, I don't really know anything in the market that does this. So this is really going to, I think, do some damage, so to speak. Good damage. But it's going to do some damage, I think, to the other brands that are competing with this. And if I was any other brand other than Sony, I'd be quite worried. Because this is now the benchmark, and it's only going to get better.
Yeah. With the price that it comes with, I think
I mean,
gives a lot.
I mean, there are brands, we won't name names, but there are brands that are 4 or 5 times the price of this with less features.
True.
And the only argument is that they've been around longer and the look is nice, but is that worth $80,000 more? No.
No.
No. And in the end of the day, like you said, you can't tell what's been shot on these days because everything is so good. So again, you're buying the time. What Sony's doing is they're not selling cameras anymore. They're selling you time. You're getting time back.
Oh, that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, do you guys have, because it's available on FX6 where you can install an application on your iPhone and then you can remote control the FX6 with the ND, with the ISO and everything. Does that happen also with the Burano?
So I think the Burano, I'm not too sure on that, but I know with the FX6 I do that quite a lot.
Yeah.
There's Content Browser Mobile is the app name. I actually was shooting with the FX6 not so long ago. We were doing a shoot for Speedo, and we had the camera suspended over a pool. And I was able to change zoom, focus, white balance, ND, press record, playback, all with my phone. So that's an amazing app. I mean, I saved so much money just on that technology right there, you know. So it does work with a lot of the Sony cameras. I would be very surprised if the Burano doesn't work with it.
Okay, that's amazing. Mm. Regarding heat, how does it function in heat?
Well, I've had it out in the Dubai desert shooting all day, so it's not let me down yet.
Right.
But it's so new. So I think it's hard to do the R&D on this justice. It may have faults. I mean, this is something that's from Japan, or this is the base prototype model. So when it's out in March, I think the industry will quickly tell you if there is something wrong with it. But I've used it quite fiercely in the short time that I've had it, and it's not let me down once. So, and to be fair, the cameras in Sony have never really let me down. I'm talking about the video cinema line here. So like even the FS7s, I've had them out in 50 plus degrees heat all day, and they've not failed. The small A7s are a bit susceptible to overheating.
I think because also the design is
very small, there's
not much space for the fans.
That's not a Sony problem. I think any small camera will overheat like that.
Definitely.
But these have very big vents and fans on the side. If you can, I mean, I can turn this around so you can sort of see it.
Yeah. I think it would handle the heat because I've used the FX6 in the heated summer of Kuwait and it survived. So I think
I mean, this thing's fine. They should be good.
Right. So it comes also with native dual native ISO, right?
Yeah, that's another amazing feature. So like all cinema cameras in the Sony line, this has a dual base ISO.
Okay.
So just for the viewers, if you don't know what that is, every camera has its cleanest image to a certain set ISO. It's not the lowest. People think it's usually like the lower the ISO, the better. Not correct.
Which happens in photography.
Happens in photography, but in video you have a native ISO where you get the optimum cleanliness of the image, so the less noisy image. Sony have developed a dual base, so it means you have a sensitive mode and a non-sensitive mode. So if you're shooting outdoors, you use the non-sensitive. So for this camera, it's 800. So that means that you obviously still have to need an ND potentially, but it's less sensitive. And then you have a 3200. So if you're shooting in an environment indoors, you can put the high base ISO on, and that's still very, very, it's like still very clean. It's a little bit different to the 800, but you don't notice the difference. It's very small.
So again, the first base ISO is 800 or 640?
800 and 3200 on this.
Okay. So if I compared between FX6 on 3200 to Burano, will I have similarity in the cleanest image, or I will find the Burano way better than the FX6?
So the high base ISO on the FX6 is 12,800.
Ah, okay.
Very high. It's almost too high, I'd say.
It is.
Because I hardly use it. And if I do use it, I'm using NDs. Because like you'll find it so sensitive, you have to use NDs even indoors.
Most people use it in a very dark situation, outdoor, in the desert.
Yeah.
For source light off a moon.
Yeah, I mean, you can literally point the FX6 up at the sky, providing the light pollution's okay, and pick up stars of that thing. It's crazy sensitive. So this is something just to make it very, very clear. Yeah. I had this question yesterday in the workshop. If you're between 800 and the high base, so if you're, let's take the FX6, 800 to 12,800, those are the two ISO ranges. If you're between those, if you deliberately go to the flexible ISO mode and you go between 800 and 12,800, it will be noisy.
You need to explain what is the flexible ISO mode, because that doesn't happen in every camera.
No, sure. So so there's usually, you can set a button on the camera that enables you to just go press and it changes the two ISOs. But you also have the freedom to change the ISO range in between as well.
Yes.
Which is obviously important because it gives you more room to play with your shot, but it's not necessary. And if you've got like the FX3, it's very easy to do it in the FX3, for example. So you can go to the flexible ISO, and you can go from 800 to 12,800, and you've got to go up the dial, up the ISO range, and you'll find that when you're on 10,000, it's very, very noisy, and then bam, you go to 12,800, and it becomes clean again.
Yeah.
So that just gives you a good indication, and you can see that with the sensor cap on. So if you press a record on the camera, and you go up the ISO range, you can see the noise increase, and then it goes clean again. So this is a good experiment for you to do at home if you have an FX3.
Nice. So do you recommend, because we had the workshop with Sony Venice 2, we had to choose, like, for example, which is also available at the FX6, you have the base, which is 800, and then you can dial down or up, depend on the range that you just mentioned. Would you recommend to do that? Because you set up your base, but then you can dial up or low to a certain number, or you recommend that, no, you work strictly with what the camera provides you as a number.
Yeah. Yeah, no, work with the base and then dial your ND. So if you're at 800 and you need more low light performance, go to 12,800. It probably would be too bright. So then you apply the ND.
All right.
That's what you do.
My other question is regarding the frame rate. So because I didn't have an experience with Burano, so all my experience is either FX6 or Sony Venice 2.
Yeah.
So when we were working with the Sony Venice 2 and we had a quite problem when we switched to higher frame rate, we couldn't record the sound anymore. So is that also happening in Burano, or no? Actually, when you go to, let's say, 60 frame per second, you still can capture sound.
So Sony have two ways in which you can capture high frame rates. You have you have just changing your base frame rate from like 24, 25, 30 up to 60 or more. Most likely, I think it's 60 on most models with the higher resolutions. and that records audio. What I recommend people do if they're not worried about sound is they record, they have their base frame rate at what their project is. So if it's 25, put it to 25, and you press S and Q, which stands for slow and quick.
Okay.
So that would basically be slow motion and quick motion. So like time lapse versus high frame rate, slow motion recording. That will turn off the audio, because what it does is it enables more processing power to go to baking in information into the slow-mo recording of the clip. What it also means is that when you play back the clip, you're actually playing it back at slow-mo. So there's no higher frame rate that you need to click on in your non-linear editing system and then reduce it down to, you don't reduce the speed down, for example. So if I shoot for a second at 100 frames per second, I'm actually getting 4 seconds worth of footage.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
A bit confusing, but I mean, in answer to your question, you can shoot higher frame rates with sound, and it will vary depending on the resolution you're shooting. So with the FX6, I can shoot 4K 50 or 60 with sound, no problem.
Okay.
I know like on the FX3, you can shoot 100 frames per second with sound, no problem. But the S&Q is, I think, better because you conserve card space and you get it played back at slow motion. So it means that you can review your shots better on set. So, but if the sound is important to you, then you can do that.
All right. I want to talk more about the IBIS technology.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a person who's not a fan of an IBIS, to be honest with you.
Me too, actually.
Because I don't like the computer or artificial intelligence deciding to control and decide for me how to stabilize the image. But not mentioning any brand name, but I've been lately working with a different camera from a different brand. And when I see the footage in the editing software, I realize the way they stabilize it is quite different from any other camera. You see wobbling.
Warping, yeah.
Yeah, it's too much. Like, it's crazy.
Mm.
So I came to understand that each camera and each brand has a different technology when it comes to the IBIS. So I would like to know more about it in the Sony.
Okay, so the five-axis IBIS in the Sony cameras is very, very good. You have two modes. You have active and standard.
Okay.
Standard is like a little bit. Active is where you actually have a crop factor, and it's a bit more active. Now, what it would mean is that if you're like wobbling the camera, for example, it won't detect any wobbles. So that's quite useful if you're, you know, doing something on a telephoto lens and you're just trying to get a nice steady shot. So that's where it really, really is useful. Where IBIS lets you down is if you've got aggressive vibration, like if you mounted an FX3 or 30 onto a car and it goes driving, because the IBIS is being pushed so much, you get this like jello wobbling effect.
Yeah.
Which is where something like the FX6 is better, because all the Rialto on the Venice 2, because it's a locked sensor, therefore providing you rig it securely, it will be a steady shot. But the benefit to the FX6, for example, and this is why I think it's better than the FX3, is that people say, well, the FX6 doesn't have IBIS. It's like, well, that's better because it records metadata into the file that you can then import into Sony Catalyst Prepare, which is a software that Sony have. And then you're able to leverage the IBIS in the software. So you can choose your crop factor and you can choose what it looks like. Or you can choose not to do it with like something like the FX30 or 3. You can turn it off, but providing, if it's very, very shaky, you'll still get that wobble because the sensor is not locked. It will still vibrate inside the body of the camera. So with the Burano, it is interesting that they have included it with IBIS, but I mean, I don't think it's a game changer. I think if you have something that's high end that requires complex rigging, I still think that's a bit too big to be rigged. That's where the Rialto and the Venice 2 really comes into play. So I understand why they've included this with IBIS, because it's more seen as a docu run and gun style camera where the IBIS would be beneficial. So I understand why they've done it. For me, I think it would be nice if it was without, but I think it's better suited as a product to include it.
But you can switch it off, right?
Yeah, but like I said, the IBIS can be turned off, but if you have it under extreme vibration, you get that jellying effect, which you don't get with something like a Venice 2.
All right. When it comes to the battery time, I believe Sony do last longer than most of the cameras, especially the cinema cameras, where they eat a lot of power.
Mm.
So how long does it run with you on, let's say, which battery that you're having in?
Well, this isn't my battery. I mean, I was running some low wattage batteries. That's 145 watts, so this is a pretty strong one. I mean, you'll get 40 minutes to an hour of constant recording with something like around like a 90 watt or something. I mean, I think it's very conservative. I mean, you need to, it depends on the battery used. I mean, this has a V-mount. So you would be using V-mount third-party batteries, depending on your size. Obviously, the bigger the battery, the better. But the good thing is that it's not completely hungry.
Oh, nice.
You know, the FX6 is the same. It's a very conservative use of battery. The only camera in the fleet that I think is a bit hungry in power is the FX9. Everything else is usually quite conservative.
Another reason to sacrifice the FX9.
Well, the FX9 it does have its place, but it is, to be honest, it's old. It's old now, so it's the least loved one. But yeah. I mean, I do still use it sometimes. I still use it sometimes because it is technically, excluding the Burano in Venice, it is technically still the highest quality camera in the fleet because of the 6K sensor. So you don't like it. Have you used it?
No.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
You try it sometime.
Just to understand.
Yeah, but I mean, it's obviously it was the FS7 replacement, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it was good in its time.
I'm a really big fan of FX6.
Yeah, the 6 is phenomenal. They've done a cracking job there. I don't know how they can improve it.
By adding electric viewfinder and also 6K resolution.
There you go.
Yeah, but the price tag is quite
different. Yeah, no, true.
But what I really love about the Burano, like I'm looking at the size right now, it's, as you mentioned, it's good for solo operators. And many people who would love to move into a bigger and higher quality camera, and they always get afraid of using a bigger camera, which requires two people with you on set in order to rig it. But this one looks quite simple and easy to be used.
Oh, very much. You can use this yourself all day, no issue.
Amazing. So, anything else you would like to talk about?
I mean, I don't know. Do you want to talk more about the clientele or the growing as a content creator or any client stuff or any more of the cinema line? What do you think?
Actually, yesterday I was watching the stories of your workshop in AAB, and I've catched something that you were saying that don't wait for clients to come to you, but actually go and approach them.
Yeah.
And we have this lot of question that why I don't get projects, why I don't get client. But the thing is, you should change that way of thinking, waiting for something to come to you, because you can always approach them.
True.
So do you want to elaborate more about this topic?
So the question is, how do you become busy effectively as a content creator and get the right clientele? Is that what
you're saying? And how do you... let's say, I don't know if that's the right way to say it, sell yourself, because today we do not need agency or agent for our work, but we can use our social media platform to promote ourselves in order to get more projects.
So I think it's a misconception that people think social media gets clients. I don't think it does.
You don't think so?
Social media has its place, but it's like branding.
Okay.
Like social media is a warming up tool.
All right.
So if you meet someone and you get their details and you build rapport and then they check out your social media, that's where social media is really useful, because it reaffirms them that you've got good social proof, you're credible, your work is there. But people won't probably find you on social media and then go, I want a video.
That's how it works in Kuwait.
Really? People DM you?
We like, even for casting, sometimes we'll just go randomly on Instagram, be like, oh, that's a good looking man, let's get him on this TV commercial.
Okay. I think I would be very surprised if that is the case all the time. I think the majority of the industry, I think people, like for me, I think leaning on a supplier to hire for a production, I would be very nervous going in blind on a social media page. I would ask someone, do you know anyone? I would refer someone. Referrals and word of mouth, I think, is the best way to grow as a filmmaker, is what I would say. And I think that knowledge may be, have a few exceptions in here in Kuwait, but I think for the majority of the world, I think, if you have a good portfolio, good reputation, you have a good product, and you have a good network of people, you will get good word of mouth business. And I think if you can find a way to grow that, that's better. I actually have a methodology in my filmmaking course to help filmmakers grow called ECV when it comes to growing as a filmmaker. I call it ECV. So the first one is E, it's extraordinary. I think for the first step of you growing as a filmmaker, you have to learn to become extraordinary at creating a really good customer experience. And this goes back to what I said earlier, where you don't just focus on the video and the edit. It's how the client was handled before the production and afterwards. And if you can, like if you right now take your last 10, 20 projects and just reverse engineer the customer's experience, write down what could you do to be better, because there's always room to improve. Definitely. And look at all elements. If you can look at ways to be constantly doing that, you'll eventually stand out. And when you become extraordinary, you'll get better word of mouth and better business and more clients. And when you get more clients and more opportunities, you can be more niche and be picky with what work that you do. And that's when you can charge more prices. So for you to grow in the best way possible, the first part is to learn to become extraordinary. If your product is not good, then you're not going to do well. Like, it's just very, very important. Like, and it doesn't necessarily mean that your editing or your shooting has to be phenomenal. Like McDonald's is not the best burger, but people go there and it's very, very successful as a burger chain because it's very, very efficient. It's consistent. You go there, you know what you're getting. You can go to Japan and get the same Big Mac as you would do if you went to anywhere else in the world. So that's part of the actual experience. The second one is C, credibility. So you've got extraordinary, you've got credibility. So credibility is what you need to give someone that no buyer's remorse, or to remove any smoke screens of you being a risk, because it's a very hard to understand product content. So you need to give people as much confidence as possible. So by having a good portfolio, by having testimonials, by having case studies, and having lots of examples on your social media or website or portfolio, or if people can send your work to clients or prospects, that's going to also help you grow as a filmmaker. And the last thing is visible. So ECV, extraordinary, credibility, and visibility. You need to be visible. So yes, posting on social media helps, but you physically need to go out and shake hands with people. You can't be sitting at home thinking that deals will come to you. If you are proactive and you make yourself known to people, you will grow as a filmmaker. So if you're thinking, okay, so let me give this advice to someone that's so new, so this is a bit more applicable. Imagine you're very, very new. You don't have any clients. You don't even have a portfolio, and you don't even know what to niche. Okay, you don't know what to niche in, but you want to grow. So the best advice I can give is you just need to go out and do as many projects as possible before you niche. So let's say you go out and you do some events, you do some food, you do some automotive, you do some corporate work, you do some weddings, you do whatever. And once you've got enough projects beneath your belt, you don't have to be charging for this. You can just be doing it just for free, or just to get the experience, to get the camera time. When you've got enough projects behind you, you can look at what paid you the most or what did you enjoy the most. And that's what your target market is. And once you kind of figure out what you want, your niche to be, you just need to go out and make your portfolio geared towards that target market. So you've identified the fish, and then you've identified the bait of what the fish would find attractive. So if your target market is restaurants, then you need to make sure that your portfolio reflects as many restaurant or food related content as possible. And if you don't have a lot of food clients or restaurant clients yet, just go out and work with 5 or 6 restaurants. Just go up to them and say, can I shoot your menu, or can I shoot some food items for you? And if it's good, will you pay me? But you don't have to, no low risk to you. You don't know me, I've come to you. Let me just do this for you and you see what it's worth. Forget the monetary exercise here. Just do it so you get the portfolio together. And then that way, when someone checks you out, you've got the portfolio, which is exactly what your target market is looking for. And it's that sort of adapting and that sort of implementation that people should be doing to be visible. You need to be going out and shaking hands with people. It's also, you leave a lot of value on the table as well when you go to something like a restaurant and you say, can I shoot some XYZ for you? And you don't ask for a referral or a testimonial afterwards. We're not very good as filmmakers at promoting ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, when was the last time you asked a client for a testimonial?
Never.
Never. But if you said, if I do a really good job at the end of this project, would you awfully mind if I filmed a testimonial or got at least 2 or 3 referrals to someone else? If you ask that up front, most likely they'll turn around and say, yes, no problem. And when you do that, because you've already brought it to their attention, it's something you want to do, you've managed the expectations.
Yeah.
That's something to capitalize on. Now, it may not always work, but you only need it to work 1 out of 10 jobs and you've got more business than you had before. And it's this sort of thing where you need to be constantly reminding yourself that you need to remain visible. There are so many talented filmmakers I know in Dubai that are not getting business because they're just not making themselves visible enough. Social media is one small part of it. You've got to physically get around to events and start shaking hands with people to make a difference and to start getting that revenue up. And only when you've got enough deals in front of you can you be picky, can you charge more, and can you be successful as a filmmaker? Otherwise, you're always going to be fighting for business. We're constantly in this rut of we're shooting, we're editing, we're not able to sell because we're busy. And then we're like, oh, we've got no work. Let's go out and start, you know, let's do some selling. And then we get busy again. And then we get sidetracked. We can't sell. And then we end up with no work again. And we're in this vicious cycle. I think it's this feast of famine where we go really, really busy and then no work. Really, really busy and then no work. really, really busy in their work. And this is what filmmakers struggle with.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice, especially for people who are new to this scene, to go and basically reach out. Don't wait. Mm. You mentioned something, which is that you have the extraordinary credibility and
visibility.
In Kuwait, we lack the first two because we don't have the community where we reach out and shake hands. So that's why we rely too much on visibility and using Instagram.
Yeah.
Even if you meet up any filmmaker or director, nobody having a website.
True.
They only rely on their Instagram profile. Mm. So I think it's a good way to change.
Yeah.
And also asking for a testimonial regarding your clients will help to improve your work.
Yeah.
I think that's really good advice.
No, sure. Thank you.
Anything else, Tim?
No, I mean, good.
We're good. And we have some food to eat also.
We have food to eat.
Yeah. It was a pleasure meeting you again. And I hope to meet you more. And maybe work together.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And welcome to Kuwait. Anytime you're here again, just let me know, because I would love to take you to some good restaurants.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here. And yeah, thank you so much for hosting me today. Cheers.
Oh, no worries. Thank you.